welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Today, first up, we are going to welcome South Dakota's Governor Dennis Dugard to the program. Governor Dugard, we're reaching him from Pierre. Welcome, sir, to In the Moment.
Thank you, and good morning.
How are you today?
I'm pretty well. I guess I'm waiting to get socked in by a bunch of snow.
Right. We start preparing early, and hopefully by the time it comes, we're ready.
Yes, that's right. Looks like it's going to be a pretty good storm.
Let's start with the inauguration and your trip to Washington, D.C. What was that experience like?
Oh, I enjoyed it very much. Lynn and I had been to an inauguration for President Bush 12 years ago, but and I was lieutenant governor then. As governor, you really get treated very well. Huh. We got there on about midnight Wednesday night, and Thursday morning we got up and met with 152 South Dakota National Guard soldiers and airmen who were there to help provide security. There were several thousand National Guard from around the nation. They were all gathered at the Redskins Stadium to be sworn in, kind of deputized, I would call it, as Washington, D.C. police. So they'd all, en masse, held up their hand and swore to be D.C. policemen. And then they assembled outside the stadium so I could thank them for helping our nation as we had a peaceful transfer of power.
Yeah. What was that moment like for you to see all those South Dakota National Guard members there participating in that rather unique way?
Oh, it was great. And they were very thrilled, I think, to be part of it.
Yeah.
I'm sure many of them would not otherwise have the opportunity to travel to D.C. for an inauguration event like this. And so I think they were excited about it and very happy to be participating. Then later that afternoon, I met with a number of senators, U.S. senators from the Senate Finance Committee. They had invited about 10 governors to talk to them about the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid reform. And so each of the governors took turns. We each got about 5 minutes to give our opinions about the Affordable Care Act and particularly about Medicaid reform. And there are a number of things that the states had in common, and then some, of course, states are different from one another. I talked about, at first, I really had three main points I made. First, that South Dakota is in financially good shape, and we're very careful. Lowest unemployment rate in the nation, high labor participation rate, budget surpluses, AAA ratings, well-funded pension. Many states can't say those things. So we're in good financial shape as a state. Then I talked about the things we had in common with other states, that we wanted to be, we wanted fewer rules in the way the Medicaid program is governed, because to the extent that the federal government shifts to a block grant program or a per beneficiary block amount from the federal government, they're shifting risk to the state. And if they're going to shift risk to the state, they need to relieve us from the restrictions. For example, promoting work, give us the ability to require those Medicaid recipients who can work to do so or be referred to work. And yet don't demand that of every recipient, because there'll be some Medicaid recipients who cannot work or maybe have three kids at home and they're a single parent and it's better for them not to work, maybe, and it's economically backtracking to work. So those kinds of things give us more flexibility and don't bound that flexibility with federal limitations and borders.
Hmm.
And then I talked about how South Dakota is different from the states in one particular respect that's a key problem for us, and that's how the federal government has shifted some of the cost of Native American health care onto the state by failing to provide good care at Indian health service facilities, causing those Native Americans who are Medicaid eligible to go outside Indian health care systems and get their care from other providers who then we must cover half the cost of that care. So I guess I reflected and reiterated what some of the other states had said, and then was particular about our unique situation with Native Americans. There might be a few other states that share that problem, but it's
was there a response? Was there a time for any feedback for you from the senators from the Finance Committee?
Yes. You know, I was a little bit worried that it might be just, hey, let's get them in. We'll go through the motions.
Mm-hmm.
We'll demonstrate that we're interested, or at least create that impression, but really then we'll move on. But I will say two things. One, during the past 6 years as governor, I've never been invited to give the state's perspective. We as governors, as a group, have never been invited to give the state's perspective on policy changes that are being considered at the federal level. So the fact that we were invited is a first, for me anyway. And then secondly, there was genuine engagement. A lot of the senators were scribbling furiously notes, and they asked questions. And at the end, our own senator, John Thune, said, well, one thing that would help, he said, is if the federal government comes up with something, or particularly in the Senate, where the party control is fairly evenly divided between Democrats and Republicans. Republicans have just a bare majority. Said, if we want to get something through the Senate that's good for the states, then we need to know from the states speaking in a more as much a unified voice as possible what you want, so that we don't adopt something that the states don't like, and then it falls apart because governors are telling their senators, I don't support this, it's not good for our state. So I think we have an opportunity now as governors to return to the Senate with some particular suggestions. And I know some of my counterparts are going to lead that, and I want to be involved, and I told them so. So we'll see.
So that's what happens next, is sort of, again, coming back with even more specifics from what would benefit South Dakota regarding Affordable Care Act replacement. Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
That's right. And and in particular, Medicaid reform.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I would say most particularly Medicaid reform.
So the big news of the morning, obviously, was President Donald Trump and an executive order regarding Keystone XL pipeline and Dakota Access pipeline. And I'm wondering, where does that leave the state of South Dakota in their relationship with TransCanada? Is it starting from scratch at this point?
No, and that's a very good question. As you may recall, TransCanada went to the Public Utilities Commission, as they must, at the first round of seeking permission from the states to cross the states with the pipeline. They went through a considerable period of hearings, opponents and proponents, and then the Public Utilities Commission issued a permit with quite a few conditions and gave them permission in a specific corridor, specific locations where the pipe would be permitted, and then that permit expired because of the delays at the federal level and maybe in Nebraska a little bit too. Then TransCanada came back to South Dakota, even though there was no change in position at the federal level. They came back to South Dakota and said, we want to renew our permit in hopes that at some point we'll get federal approval. So they went through a new permitting hearing, somewhat abbreviated because much of the evidence had already been presented on both sides, and a new permit was provided by the PUC, and that permit, as I understand it, is still in effect. So right now they do have a permit to lay the pipe in South Dakota in a very specific corridor, and I do not believe they have such a permit in Nebraska, where their route is supposed to go. So they
so
could,
have their
in theory.
Go ahead.
Excuse me. They could, in theory, begin construction in South Dakota, but they couldn't complete the pipeline without a Nebraska permit. And I'm not sure where things stand in Montana. This pipeline, you might remember, does not go through North Dakota. It goes through Montana and then enters South Dakota at the very northwest corner where we border Montana. And then it comes down through South Dakota on the west side of the Missouri River. It does not cross the river. And then exit South Dakota, I think in Tripp County, if I remember right, on the Nebraska border.
Have there been any conversations at this point with TransCanada officials about beginning that construction?
They haven't contacted me since the order, obviously, this morning.
Sure.
I was aware they renewed their permit, and I was aware they continued to hope that the federal policy would change, and now it has. So I expect they're going to be considering what their options are, whether to begin construction in multiple states or in those states where they have permits or what.
And certainly much has changed since that process with the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota and the protests and the millions of dollars that impacted the North Dakota state budget as well. And I'm curious to know if those thoughts sort of cross your mind if construction begins with Keystone XL, if we could see a similar situation with opponents of a pipeline here in our state.
It's possible. It's possible. It's hard to say. In North Dakota, of course, there was very much a point of contention, a geographic point of contention. The pipeline had been completed virtually everywhere except at the crossing of the Missouri River. And so there is very much a location where those opposed could assemble and make their opposition publicly known and visibly known. That wouldn't be the case with TransCanada, because to the extent that there's multiple construction sites going on with multiple contractors, I don't know that it would be as easy to congregate at a known location. And the other thing about the Dakota Access Pipeline, you have to remember, they were allowed to congregate on public land.
Mm-hmm.
And this pipeline would more likely be, I think it's all pretty much on private land. And so to the extent that people start to assemble on private land, I don't know that they would be allowed to congregate in many numbers before there'd be the objection by the private landowner, hey, you're on my front lawn, you're in my field, you're in my yard.
Hmm. Were you in contact with North Dakota's governor throughout that process?
With throughout
the Dakota Access Pipeline protests and the law enforcement response there, did you have a lot of contact with North Dakota's governor at that point?
No, I've been very good friends with Governor Dalrymple. We spent some time, on Memorial Day, Jack and Betsy came to South Dakota and spent Memorial Day weekend with Linda and me, and we've been up to Bismarck and spent a couple of overnight stays with them for social reasons. We have talked on occasion when we've been together socially or when we've been together at governor meetings, but we have, of course, we've provided some law enforcement support at their request. We have a compact with North Dakota and many other states where, in case of a disaster or law enforcement need, the states can call upon their neighbors to send help. We call upon our neighbors to send help virtually every year for the Sturgis Rally. We get law enforcement help there. We call on our neighbors when we have a disaster, and they send help, whether it might be electric line people to help with restoration of power, or we had National Guard helicopters from Illinois and other states when we had the flood in the Missouri. So the states routinely support one another when we have public needs. And I will not generally be directly involved in that. It's more of a public safety to public safety communication that goes on. And so, no, we've had conversations. I know as he was leaving office, he was anxious about this because he worried that, hey, I'm leaving office and now here comes the new governor and this is still unresolved and a big expense to the state when they're having some revenue shortfalls as a consequence of low oil prices.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to In the Moment, South Dakota Public Radio. My guest is Governor Dennis Dugard. He's joining us live from Pier. And Governor, I want to make sure we talk about Spearfish Canyon and the possibility of a land exchange, state park there. The very first time you and I ever spoke, this was after last State of the State address, and we were talking about it in a very positive way, and I remember your eyes just sort of lighting up about the idea of preserving natural resources and stuff. Now it's gotten more complicated as sort of the details come out and we walk through the process of what can happen and what people want to happen. Where are you at right now as far as taking public input about the possible land exchange, and what kind of input is your office getting?
Well, first let me say that I think I have made some mistakes in messaging, because I think people think it's all one decision, and it's really three decisions that the state needs to make with input from citizens. The first decision is, shall we exchange land? Shall we have a situation where the federal government owns more land and the state owns a little bit? Or should we have a situation where that little bit is a little bit larger that the state holds and the federal government holds the surrounding area as well? So that's just a question of exchange. And in my mind, that question is wholly apart. And in fact, there's no legislation this session to create a state park. It's just a question, should we exchange land? Because the state already owns land in Spearfish Canyon, and the federal government already owns land in Spearfish Canyon. So shall we exchange that land so that the state has more of it? I think we should. And the reason I think so is because the state is more nimble and more able to more quickly provide resources to satisfy the needs of our citizens, the wishes of their citizens, and protect the environment. As an example, before the state had possession of some of the land that we now hold, there was... the only way to get access to the base of Spearfish Falls was to ford the stream and follow a dirt path, some of which was trespassing on homestead land, and then get to the base of the waterfall, and you're on the land itself. And what was happening is people were eroding the stream bank at the base of the falls, and there was a lot of damage being done. When the state gained ownership of that property with the help of the Spearfish Canyon Foundation, the state now has built a footbridge over the river and created an improved path and created a platform at the base of the falls so people can get where they want to get without walking on the stream bank, without damaging the plant life there, without eroding the stream bank and causing silt into the river, or the stream rather. And so you have better access, safer access, and a more protective access for the environment. The federal government doesn't have the ability to quickly respond, and they're spending most of their national forest money on wildfires. So their ability is not for lack of interest, but it's just because all their money is being sucked up by wildfires. Hmm. So the question is, should we exchange the land? I think the answer to that, by virtually anyone who understands the situation, is yes, we should. The second question, and we won't even reach that this year because there's got to be an environmental impact statement, is whether the state should create a park. And that's a legislative decision. I can't decide to create a state park. Game Fish and Parks can't. Only the legislature can. There's a statute that lists by name our 13 state parks, and a state park cannot be created unless the legislature adds to that list. So this is a decision that is not being made this year, and if the city or if the state decides not to, it might even occur after I'm done being governor, because it takes a while. So that decision is wholly apart from the land exchange decision. It's not one decision. And then the third decision, the one that people that I've heard are more concerned about, is will fees be charged? And that's still a third decision. We own lots of land in South Dakota that is a recreational area or game production area or walk-in hunting area, where a natural area where people have access without any fees. And obviously, we'd be happy to have revenue from fees to the extent that they can support some of these improvements and maintain them. But if the citizens are strongly opposed to that, we don't have to have fees charged just because we own the property. In fact, we could create a state park and have no fees. There's nothing in law or regulation that requires fees be charged for access to a state park. It normally is, but it doesn't mean it has to be, because there's nothing in law that would require it. So they're really three separate decision points. All I'm asking this year is for the first decision point. Should we exchange land? And I don't think I've heard from anyone who opposes that concept. It's the fees that they're concerned about. And again, that's not a necessary part. We already have access to the land that the bridge is on, the falls is on. We could call that a state park and charge fees for that today.
Is there evidence, sir, of the similar kind of overuse or erosion in the area that we're talking about? Do you have another example of how use is currently damaging the environment, or does that not apply to this land that we're talking about today?
No, it's not so much. It's not only, well, yes, I can go back. One other parcel that we have now is Rufflock Falls. That's further up the canyon. And the state had to do the very same thing when it gained access to that land. So we've already gone in and installed quite a bit of improvements in Rufflock Falls to, again, give access to the bank and give access to the falls to people in a way that protects the falls. And that was, when we gained access to it, was littered and, again, eroding. And the state has taken that and much improvement. If you haven't yourself been there, I encourage you to go there, and you'll be amazed at the beauty and the protection that is in place.
I am planning a trip so I can see, because it's true. It's hard unless you've been out there to really fully understand the story, unless you've sort of walked around and seen what they're talking about. So we're working to put that together. So I'll have to get a tour guide. Yes. So my question.
I invite the public to come and offer their thoughts and hear more about it. Our first information meeting is in Spearfish on Thursday at 7 o'clock Mountain Time. And so the public is welcome to come to that. Or you can go online and express your attitude. There's a website. I think if you just plugged in Spearfish Canyon, you'd probably come to the website if you Googled that.
Right. We'll put a link up on our website, too. Lieutenant Governor gave us that, and it slips my mind right now. I should have that at the tip of my fingers, but I don't. So we'll put a link up after the program. My question is, then, if the land exchange, the first part of that decision comes, and then the state park is not approved, what happens to the land that's then in state property?
Then it'd probably be treated as just a recreation area or a game production area, probably a recreation area, and we have other recreation areas all over the state that don't give rise to a state park. Now, those areas would not be as improved. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't have some of the amenities that you might have at a state park, but you certainly have the ones that are already in place. So it'd be a pretty improved recreation area, much more so than most are, but the state would just own it as a recreation area.
Yes, and then the improvements seem to be what I'm hearing from listeners that they're the most sort of hesitant about, because, and we talked to Secretary Hepler before, and he said he didn't even like the word, I think I used the word development, and he said it was more of an enhancement. But it does seem like a lot of listeners have concerns about what those improvements might be, and they like the people who are contacting us on both sides, but the ones who are against the exchange like the rustic nature of it. Are you hearing that at all and taking that into consideration?
Well, the only improvements that I've heard suggested are paving the gravel road that exists today, and that would, I think, improve control of dust and give people a little easier access. Now, if they like gravel roads, then I suppose there's those that do and those that don't, so that's one possible improvement. Another improvement is the creation of a trail from Savoy Pond down to the top of Spearfish Falls, and then connect to the trail that comes down to Roughlock Falls. So it would just be an extension of some existing trails. Part of the land exchange also involves some property that includes Bismarck Lake. And right now, Bismarck Lake has only a vault toilet, and the campers there are going across the road and invading the Custer State Park campsite shower facilities, which is really unfair to the people who are using that campground. It's fine if there's not much utilization, but if the campground in the park is full, to have the Bismarck Lake campers from the Forest Service land come over and use the state facilities, it's really unfair. And so we would build at least that's a proposal. Again, these public hearings are to judge what the public wants. And so one suggestion that could be approved, supported, or rejected is a shower facility at Bismarck Lake. Another improvement that has been suggested is the septic system at Camp Barb Marshall. The septic system there is not protecting the environment well, and we would improve the septic system so that you don't pollute with an inadequate septic system. Those are the improvements that I've heard. You know, the trail to the falls, the bridge, the platform overlooking the falls, the platform of the base, they're already built or nearly complete. And those are protective. And if people like rustic, that's fine, but rustic is sometimes damaging to the natural environment.
Thursday, then, are the public hearings, the first public hearing is being held. How do you take that kind of input and, I guess one of the concerns I've heard from listeners is that decisions been made. So how do you sort of have that ongoing dialogue with citizens who have a concern and go back and forth? How does that even work?
Well, I think that's the nature of every decision at every level of government or even outside of government. It's through exchange of opinion. Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to create as many forums where opinions can be exchanged. And remember that the decision about whether to create a park is a legislative decision. I can't do it by executive fiat. Mm-hmm. All I can do is agree with it if the legislature decides to do it. So to the extent that the public wants to exert its will, I mean, they've got elected officials whose position is subject to the will of the voters. So if they don't want to have a public park, they can make it known to the legislator. They could even refer that, a bill that creates the public park, refer that back to the voters. So
sure. There's
certainly a lot of control in the public arena.
A great transition to our final topic, which is initiated Measure 22 and sort of ethics in state government. That was a voter-approved ballot measure. Problems with the constitutionality of it in certain areas, and now the state legislature is trying to, repeal the entire thing. Has this become sort of a public relations problem or a problem, once again, with communicating with the voters that ethics matters and we're willing to take strong steps to increase ethics in state government, but yet not this? Where do you stand on that right now?
Well, I think the voters have been... The messaging to the voters has been largely driven by those who support the measure, and the supporters are from Massachusetts. 98% of the money that supported this measure came from this Massachusetts group or out of state, and the measure was written by a Boston lawyer, and it's driven by out-of-staters, and their methods of promoting it have been, I think, highly misleading. Their most prominent ad, in fact, I don't know if I've seen an ad other than that, implies that there's bribery going on in the state capitol, that money is being passed on and that it's somehow legal, when in fact there's an entire chapter of our criminal code that makes bribery of public officials a felony, class 5 or class 6 felony. And so those commercials are grossly misleading. And nothing is said in the commercials about the $5 million a year that will be then handed out to candidates for campaign commercials. And in a year like this one, where we're looking at revenue growth of maybe, and we're probably going to have to cut this back, our projections seem a little bit too optimistic, maybe $19 million total revenue growth for the entire fiscal year 17 to 18. Well, when you've only got $20 million and you've got K-12 education systems, you've got higher education, you've got nursing homes that have a predominance of Medicaid patients, they all have costs that are going up and they all want an increase. And the best we can do this year is 1%. And if we have to spend $5 million on campaign commercials, that's per year. So for every election, it's $10 million. Then we'd have to cut back even that 1% to less than 1%. So I just think that voters were not told the whole story. And then the voters also were not aware, I'm certain, that this is a 34-page, 14,000-word measure that they were trying to decide based on a 30-second campaign commercial or a 200-word summary by the Attorney General. I feel sorry for the Attorney General, who's got to boil down 14,000 words into 200 and give a complete explanation. So I just think that the whole process by which this measure was brought to the voters and sold to the voters was very wrong-headed.
So is your main concern, is your main concern the process with which how it was done, and then tied to that the sort of financial impact on state budget? Are those sort of what rise to the top of your opposition to IM-22?
Oh, yes. No question. Okay. Those are major reasons for my opposition.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of an initiated measure was that citizens who had concerns could turn those concerns into a straightforward proposal that their peers supported and that they in turn voted for. It's not the idea of an initiated measure wasn't that you're going to create a very complex 14,000-word document, 34 pages long. It would take me an hour and a half to read it to you.
Are there
That's not the kind of measure that the citizens can digest and vote upon unless they've got all the information in front of them, and that's just simply not likely to occur.
Governor, we're getting an email from one of our listeners wanting to know if you would sign into law Senate Bill 67, which doubles the number of signatures needed to put an amendment on a ballot. We're going to talk to our political reporter, Lee Strubinger, later in the hour about this one. So I'll tell you right now, I don't know too much about it. So do you have a good awareness of Senate Bill 67 and where you sort of stand on it right now?
I haven't seen it. I know there are a number of ideas for trying to find the balance. And here's the question. How can you balance the need to stop out-of-state money from buying an initiated measure and then misleading the public about it to get it sold when it's part of their national agenda, not something that South Dakota citizens have themselves identified as a problem and found a solution for? So you need to somehow stop the out-of-staters from crowding our ballot and yet still preserve the right of South Dakotans to bring forth those concerns that they genuinely have themselves, not ideas planted or driven by out-of-state interests who just find willing citizens that they either pay to circulate petitions or convinced to sign petitions because they're in a hurry and they're going to the mall and, yeah, I'll sign that, not even knowing what it is.
Right. And what about ethics? What needs to change there this session to sort of respond to the voters' demands?
Well, it's interesting to me that Again, the proponents of this measure keep pointing to a report that identifies South Dakota as one of the most corrupt states in the nation. But when you ask what data they looked at to come to that conclusion, and we did, we asked the U.S. attorney for the data that backed that conclusion of that report, and that data was based almost entirely on local government problems, not state government. There were some federal problems where there was someone was convicted of misappropriating funds at the federal level. The vast majority was local government officials, including tribal government officials. And of all the instances of convictions of corruption over, I think it was a 10-year period they looked at, there was one state official. So they point to all these corruption claims that arise out of this survey or this report, but it's based on local government problems, and this is approaching the problem as if it were a state government corruption problem. Hmm. Now, I just disagree again with the way that has been sold, because they create the false impression that there are all these state officials who have enriched themselves and are corrupt and have been convicted of some crime, and that the state is full of corrupt officials. It just, again, very misleading, very false.
And, so, Governor Dugard, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but when you say that, I'm hearing that maybe not much needs to change as far as state laws regarding ethics in state government. Is that what you think?
Well, what I think we should do is look at what problems have created concern in people's minds and say, what can we do to address those problems? So, for example, we had the EB-5 issue. We had the Gear Up issue. In both cases, the legislature did respond with conflict of interest legislation, with disclosure and audit requirement legislation. So they looked at the real problem that arose and found solutions that were responsive to the real problem. Instead, what we have is a public relations gesture. In my mind, I think the ethics and the lobbyist gift legislation was all a means of selling the idea of public campaign financing. I think that's what the proponents really wanted, public campaign financing. But knowing they couldn't get that sold, they packaged it with this misleading ethics response to a problem that's local and not state, and this bribery falsity, when in fact it's already part of our criminal code. And by that packaging and their selling, then now they've got this public financing. I think that's what's really happened here.
Governor Dennis Dugard, you've been extremely generous with your time, and I've taken more of it than I promised I would. So I want to say thank you for that, for your accessibility today. Thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Good to be with you, Lori.
We'll see you next time.
Okay.
After the break, Donald Trump defied expectations by winning the presidency. A new frontline looks at how his candidacy might foreshadow that presidency. Stay in the moment. SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. President Donald Trump was elected after defeating adversaries, surviving controversy, and rallying millions. Tonight on SDPB-TV, a new frontline takes a look at what his candidacy tells us about how the new president may govern. Trump's Road to the White House airs tonight at 9 p.m. Central, 8 Mountain on SDPB-TV. With us now for a preview is frontline producer Mike Weiser. Mike, welcome back to In the Moment.
Thanks for having me.
It's nice to talk to you again. Let's look forward a little bit. Well, let's look back a little bit before we look forward. And how soon after Donald Trump declares his candidacy do the controversies really start?
You know, it really only actually the day that he announces his candidacy, he sparks the very first controversy when he talks about immigrants and describes Mexicans who are coming in to the United States as rapists and drug dealers. But it doesn't take even a couple of weeks before he sparks his second controversy, which is when he refers to John McCain and questions whether he is a war hero, as somebody who was captured. So from the very first days of Donald Trump's candidacy, it was marked by controversy, which was a pattern that continued throughout his campaign.
And his advisors respond how immediately?
Well, it was interesting. I think there was a learning curve for his advisors. We spoke to Corey Lewandowski, who was Trump's first campaign manager, and he said that after the remark about John McCain, that he went up to Trump and said, "You have to apologize. This is the type of comment to say about a member of the Republican establishment, about a POW, that he likes people who are not captured." Lewandowski says he went up to Trump and said that Trump should apologize, but that Trump said, "No, you don't understand the American people." And Lewandowski said that once he understood the way that Trump operated, that he was willing to double down on his remarks, that he was going to fight and to not apologize, not to step back. Lewandowski, at least, learned that he was going to stand by Trump. So there was an interesting relationship early on, and an interesting learning curve for Corey Lewandowski.
What does candidate Donald Trump really understand, as he says, about the American people that some of his advisors don't? What is he tapping into in those early days?
Well, Donald Trump, of course, came from a completely different background than everybody else who was running in the race. He was not a professional politician. He had dabbled in politics, but this was really his first campaign. And what he brought to the campaign initially was his skills at judging the mood of the public, his skills as an entertainer. One of the things that everybody who was involved in the campaign told us was that what was central to Trump at the beginning of his campaign and at the end of his campaign were his rallies. And he brought to these massive rallies his flair as an entertainer. He paid attention to the type of music that played as he walked into those rallies, to the way that they were staged, to where he stood, to how he looked. And these were very, for the crowds that were there, very entertaining events. And he also used the rallies in a different way. His advisors told us that one of the things that Trump would do would be to use the rallies to find out what his supporters thought. So while other candidates were using polling or focus groups, Donald Trump was speaking at his rallies and watching to see what was the reaction of the crowds, which lines did they like, which lines did they not like, and he took note of that and he adjusted his message accordingly.
Is that different than, let's go back to the sort of the entertainment factor. Is that different than how other candidates campaign? Because certainly they have to have people who are deciding where to stack the hay bales behind the candidate and things like that, who are staging the event. Do they delegate that? And he kind of had a different sort of personal engagement with it?
Yeah, he was definitely much more on top of those things, paying much more attention to, the type of music, to the way that his image was presented. I mean, he was an expert at branding. He'd built his career on building his brand, and he brought that into the presidential race. And he did do things differently than other politicians. One of the things that he did at those rallies was he knew that if he were to give the same stump speech at every rally, that the networks wouldn't follow him live. And he said in interviews that what he would do at the rallies was watch the red lights on the cameras and do whatever he needed to in order to keep the networks covering him. So he would improvise. He would say things. He would sometimes contradict himself. But he was doing what he had to stay on television, to keep them entertaining enough that the networks would continue to cover them.
And then he flips it in one of those speeches and says, "I have to give a new stump speech every time because they always carry me." He makes it sound like he's only responding. Everybody else is giving the same stump speech, but I'm so popular that I have to reinvent it every time. So he kind of makes it about him again.
That's right. I mean, in that sense, he's very transparent about what it was that he was doing, he was adjusting it for the cameras, for the rally, for the crowds at the rallies, that he was shaking things up, and he was sometimes generating controversy to keep himself in the headlines.
How does he overcome that? Because at every turn, there seems to be another comment that he says, another something that his advisors and such say that's it, it's over. Or his opponents, advisors say that's it, he's done. How is it that he overcame the controversy that, that really some people thought were distracting from what his message was?
You know, one of the interesting things, we tell the story, the John McCain story, in detail and spoke to Frank Luntz, who is the Republican pollster who was interviewing Donald Trump in those very first weeks of his campaign. And when Donald Trump makes that remark about John McCain, about him not being a war hero, he says something else which we include in the film, which is that people are tired of politically correct speech. They're tired of being told what to say. And so one of the things that Trump managed to do very successfully was to turn these controversies where supporters who might not even agree with what it was that he said liked the fact that he was breaking the rules, liked the fact that he wasn't being politically correct, liked the fact that he was taking on the establishment and saying things that other people couldn't or wouldn't say. So in some ways, for his supporters at least, he was able to turn those controversies into evidence that he was somebody authentic. He was somebody different than other sort of programmed politicians.
And that's fascinating to me, sort of how that's unfolded during the course of the documentary. And you get to that moment, the light bulb kind of comes on and you say, well, that's a really American value to sort of stand your ground and mean what you say and not always turn around and change your mind like people are frustrated seeing politicians do at every turn. I don't think I understood that before I watched this Frontline, that people were responding to that, that he didn't apologize.
That's right. And, you know, there was just controversy after controversy. And there was time after time that Donald Trump was told that what he needed to do now was to pivot, which is the phrase that they use in Washington for, say, you need to change and address a larger audience. And they said that going into the convention. They said that going into the fall when he was running against Hillary Clinton. And everybody was waiting for a moment when Trump was going to be more, quote-unquote, presidential, when he was going to avoid controversies, when he was going to try to expand his base. But throughout the campaign, he defied expectation of everybody that he was going to pivot, that he was going to change. And his top advisor, longtime political advisor, Roger Stone, who advised him on politics for decades, told us Trump is going to be Trump, and that was what the American voters wanted. And he stuck to that sort of authentic, controversy-causing character that he was on the campaign trail.
And before we run out of time, let's look forward. We've got about a minute and a half and say, some people are still looking for the pivot. They're still saying the presidency is going to change him. He's going to sort of grow into the role. And some of his advisors are saying, no, don't hold your breath for him to change. Trump is still going to be Trump. Is that kind of what what we have to expect?
That's right. It's a really interesting moment because he adopted a tactic that everybody said would not work. Throughout the campaign, up until election night, even top senior Republican Party officials believed that Donald Trump was going to lose, believed that his failure to pivot, his failure to be more presidential was going to do him in, and yet he succeeded. So he comes into the White House having heard the conventional wisdom, having ignored the conventional wisdom, and then having been rewarded for it. But governing in Washington is very different than campaigning, and the audience that he'll have to court in order to implement his agenda in Washington will be very different than the one that he had on the campaign trail. So it will be interesting to see how he adjusts and how Washington adjusts to him.
But voters are still watching. The voters are still very much engaged in him. He knows that red light is still on.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Interesting. Frontline presents Trump's Road to the White House tonight on SDPB TV at 9 Central, 8 Mountain. Mike Weiser, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll see you next time. Stick around for hour two of In the Moment. We'll hear from SDPB's Lee Strubinger about proposed legislative changes and how ballot measures are challenged and implemented in the state. Plus, Hugh Weber offers up another helping from the Potluck Society. Stay in the moment, SDPB Radio.